We'll hear arguments next in White Mountain Apache Tribe against Racker. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready now.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This case deals with the permissibility of certain state taxation concerning use of tribal and Bureau of Indian Affairs roads on the reservation when use is made by a non-Indian logger as a part of a tribal forestry enterprise. The White Mountain Apache Tribe and its logger, Pine Top Logging Company, actually one of its loggers, submit that the state taxes are barred by two separate principles of federal law. The first ground for our claim of defense to these taxes is that they are preempted by comprehensive federal regulation of the fields of managing and harvesting Indian reservation timber. Our second defense is the doctrine that state laws may not be applied even to non-Indians with respect to their dealings with Indians on the reservation, where to do so would infringe on the tribal self-government.
It's entirely immaterial, but this is a cert, isn't it? It isn't an appeal.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Any reason why you didn't take it as an appeal?
I've considered either option available and was not entirely sure and filed a cert petition.
Well,
my co-counsel, Mr. Michael Brown, will address himself to the claim of infringement of tribal self-government. The facts upon which this case arises can be stated summarily as follows. Over 100 years ago, President Grant set aside a reservation for the White Mountain Apaches in a remote and mountainous part of Arizona. Virtually the only significant resource on that reservation is the timber that grows in the mountains. Fortunately for this tribe, that resource holds out the potential for a perpetually renewable resource if wisely managed. And indeed, the tribal timber enterprise is the principal financial support for the entire tribal government and all other tribal programs. In addition, the tribal timber enterprise is a major on-reservation employer of members of the tribe. Obviously, an essential part of the program of harvesting this timber is getting the trees from off the mountain down to the tribal mill in White River, Arizona. That process requires the building and the maintenance of an extensive road system throughout the reservation. And indeed, there are literally thousands of miles of roads throughout this reservation. Most of these roads, almost all of these roads, are built and maintained by the tribe itself, either directly or through its loggers. I have brought with me an intent to submit to the clerk's office for illustrative purposes only the most recent U.S. Geological Survey map of the reservation, which gives some indication of the extent of the road system that is to be found thereon.
But do they use the state road to some degree?
Your Honor, the loggers have occasion to cross the state roads and to use them from time to time. And indeed, Pine Top Logging Company keeps precise records of all of its use of state roads, and it pays taxes with respect to those uses. This lawsuit does not involve an attempt by the state of Arizona to obtain tax payments with respect to the use of its own roads that it owns or builds or maintains or polices. Rather, this lawsuit has to do with an attempt by the state of Arizona to derive windfall profits for the benefit of its state road system, not from the use of those roads, but from the use of wholly different roads which are built and maintained and owned solely by the tribe and by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Well, you don't contend, do you, as a matter of general tax apportionment law, that a state could not exact a license fee for the use of a vehicle and devote the proceeds of that tax to maintenance of roads and base it on the value of the vehicle, and that an owner of a vehicle could nonetheless say, well, I only drive my car to church on Sunday, so although your tax would come out to be computed $100, I'm paying you $3, which I think is the value that I use your road.
Your Honor, we certainly do not make that contention, and the principles to which you refer are general principles of municipal and public law with respect to taxing authorities of various taxing entities. What we are discussing in this case is a different body of law, which is a body of federal law, which has to do with when a specific congressional regulatory scheme dealing with specific subject matters preempts interfering state laws. So the answer to your question is no, but I submit that does not answer the question before the court.
Well, then why does Pinetop keep specific records of its use on Arizona state law, on Arizona state highways?
Your Honor, the reason for that is very simple. First, our client, as a practical matter, thought it fair to pay those taxes, and as a tactical matter, we choose not to bring that lawsuit.
So, you might be able to challenge those laws, but you are electing to pay a part of the tax that's levied.
Your Honor, we do not choose to challenge the state's collection of taxes with respect to the use of its own roads. We do not admit liability. We simply have no case or controversy before the court with respect to that question.
How about the licenses on the trucks?
The trucks are licensed, Your Honor.
And they pay license fees to the...
I believe that those license fees are paid, and I would point out that they are de minimis in amount, according to my understanding. That, again, is another lawsuit not worth bringing.
Mr. Wake, can I ask you another question? Maybe this is still another lawsuit, but with respect to the 8 cent per gallon fuel tax, the statute says for the purpose of partially compensating the state for the use of its highways and so forth, the 8 cent tax is imposed. Supposing the statute said in order to generate general revenues for the state, the tax in this amount is imposed and went into the general funds. Would your case be the same?
Your Honor, that would be a slightly different case. I submit that the answer would probably be the same. And let me elaborate on that answer for a moment. Again, the fundamental concern which we submit the court must address itself to is what the subject matter and the purposes of the federal regulation is, and whether those purposes require the exclusion of these state taxes. Now, in this case, the federal government has regulated the entire field, we submit, of managing and harvesting Indian timber. These particular state taxes are offensive, not because of what they're used for, but because of how they bear upon the federal scheme. We submit that the fact that these state taxes are used for the building of unrelated state roads is part of what makes these taxes worse. It's not necessarily what makes them bad. What makes them bad is the fact that the attempt of the state of Arizona to derive tax revenues out of the tribal forestry program runs at cross purposes to the specifically identified and articulated federal purposes of the management and harvesting of tribal timber. Therefore, whether the state uses these taxes for other purposes or not is not necessarily controlling.
Well, how is that different from charging a tax, say, on sales tax or something like that on the purchase of the vehicles which are used exclusively in the logging business?
Your Honor, I would submit that in order to draw the boundaries of the reach of the preemptive force which we submit must be recognized here, one would have to look to a number of considerations, and there is no bright line test, but there are a number of overlapping considerations that are adequate for purposes of identifying the specific needs to protect against specific state intrusions into the regulatory scheme. Let me list a few of them. One is the nexus of the state assertion of jurisdiction with the direct subject matter of the federal regulation. Here, federal regulation deals specifically and directly with the process of getting the trees off the mountain down to the mill. That is the core of the entire statutory and regulatory scheme, and these taxes are an attempt to derive revenues off of that very subject matter. Now,
except that the tax is imposed when the gas is pumped into the tank, I suppose.
Your Honor, the tax is imposed under state law on the conjunction of two incidents. One is the burning of fuel to move a motor vehicle, and the other is the moving of it on a highway, a road, as it is defined.
But isn't the tax just added to the price per gallon of gasoline?
Not in this case, Your Honor. Our client, Pine Top Logging Company, purchases its diesel fuel in interstate commerce and does not pay taxes to its seller in interstate commerce. It brings the fuel onto the reservation where it is stored and ultimately used.
What if could this tax be validly imposed, and maybe I'm echoing my brother Stephen's question, on the operator of a timber company, say the Weyerhaeuser Company or something, that used its fuel and used its vehicles exclusively on its own private property?
Off of an Indian reservation?
Yes, but never on state or tax-supported roads.
In that particular situation, I believe the state tax would be properly collectible because there are no implications of federal Indian laws or policies in that situation. There would be no due process objection to the state's right to tax that.
Well, I would think there might well be. You don't represent that client, but...
Well...
Wait, just to go back for a second, because I think it's the same point Justice Stewart's asking, too. You point out that here the fuel is bought in large quantities and actually pumped on the reservation. I take it your case would be precisely the same if it were bought at retail from local gas stations off the reservation.
That would be our position, Your Honor, precisely. If it pleases the Court, I do anticipate the need for some rebuttal today, and therefore I would like to yield to my co-counsel, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The taxation which the state seeks to impose in this case is an infringement upon the sovereignty of the White Mountain Apache tribe and its right of tribal self-government. It interferes with a fundamental purpose as well as the basic nature of the reservation. One of the most basic principles of Indian law is that those powers vested in an Indian tribe are not delegated, but rather inherent powers of limited sovereignty. They are inherent in that sovereignty preexisted both the sovereignty of the state of Arizona as well as the United States of America itself. Williams versus Lee has said that the test of sovereignty when you're dealing with the affairs of non-Indians on reservations is that the tribe and the state law that each have legitimate interests, but that the right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and be ruled by them shall remain inviolate.
Congress can violate it if it so chooses. Can
yes,
it,
sir.
Under loan oath against it.
Congress has the power of defeasance to take away the sovereignty which the Indian tribes retain, but it has not yet done so. And the indications from Congress, of course, are quite to the contrary. The Congress has given, for example, in 1953, five states the right to extend their both civil and criminal jurisdiction to Indian reservations and to allow those states to accept the benefits of that as well as the responsibilities for the tribes in Public Law 280. Arizona, while not one of the five designated states, had the right and the power by several means to ascribe to Public Law 280 and accept the responsibilities for the White Mountain Apache tribe and the other tribes whose reservations are on the reservation or within the state of Arizona and refuse to do so. This lawsuit is essentially about roads and trees. And the state would like to say that it's about taxes, but it's about the fact that the White Mountain Apache tribe This reservation, which is the Fort Apache Reservation, is in northeastern Arizona. It's 1,600,000 acres. It's rural and it's mountainous and it's widespread, and the people live all over that reservation. It is not an urban area, and the major rural or urban area is White River, and it has maybe 1,000 to 1,500 people living in it. One of the designed secondary purposes of the tribal timber industry is the creation of roads. The timber industry must, in fact, create roads to get to the trees so that they can be logged, so the forest can be logged. But also, it's necessary to create adequate roads into those rural and remote areas so that we can have the ability to deliver food and essential services to remote rural areas of the reservation, and to maintain communications with those areas. And that's a direct and design product of the road building and the maintenance program of the tribe and the Fort Apache Timber Company and the loggers, who are our agents, create a good number of the roads and by contract, of course, maintain the roads pursuant to the Bureau of Indian Affairs criteria and regulations of the federal government. In Moe, this court said that, that states in dealing with actions on reservations involving Indians and non-Indians, that the state would be allowed to tax those kinds of transactions if there was a significant interest that the state had and some real economic benefit was going not to the Indian party involved in the transaction, but to the non-Indian. And that essentially what was happening was that this transaction or attempt to cloak this transaction in immunity was merely an end run by the non-Indian around legitimate taxing interests of the state. We would submit to the court that that's a valid test and that there ought to be some way that this court can draw a line quite apart from the preemption argument made in Warren Trading Post along the infringement of tribal sovereignty and the infringement of tribal self-government line.
Mr. Brown, I noticed from the atlas that State Highway 73 itself goes through White River. What is the source of the state's authority to build a highway on an Indian reservation?
Get an easement from the federal government and the tribe. We believe that the tax infringement test ought to consider at least four things. Number one, the location. Obviously, the Indian reservation itself is historically the locus where federal Indian policy is effectuated. Historically, all of this, and actually in this litigation, all of the activities involved take place within the confines of the Fort Apache Reservation on the White Mountain Apache's land held in trust for them by the federal government. Another issue is, does it interfere with the fundamental purpose or nature of the reservation? And it's inconceivable to me that with the geographical makeup of the reservation that Congress and the President in making up the reservation could not have anticipated that a tribal timber industry was going to be necessary. Number three, where does the burden truly fall on the Indian or the non-Indian? It doesn't really make any difference what you call the tax. You can call it a sales tax, a privilege tax, an excise tax, a motor carrier tax. The question is, where does the burden fall? Legal instance is just, that's just the walnut hiding what the state wants to do with a taxing scheme. In this case, it's admitted that the total economic burden and direct economic burden falls on the tribe and the tribal timber industry in that dollar for dollar, the tribe must pay to Pine Top all the money they expend for the tax. In this case, another issue and thing that I believe that the court ought to look at in formulating a test is the legitimate interests of the state and the tribe.
What about the tax on the purchase of the trucks? Suppose that Pine Top buys some trucks off the reservation and a tax is added to the purchase price, and Pine Top says, gee, I'm only going to use these on the reservation.
Yes, sir. I know that clearly that's not our case, but also
But it's clearly the case there that the burden, where the burden would, ultimate burden would fall.
Yes, sir, but that's not a direct burden. I think that's an indirect burden, because whether they pay the tax on the purchase of those trucks.
That sounds like a walnut shell, too.
Well, it may be, but it may be a little larger shell in the sense that that
well,
tax
the Indians
is more
are
indirect.
Going to pick up the tab, aren't they?
Not necessarily.
Well, what do you mean necessarily?
I think it's speculative that they'll pick up the tab. The purchase of the trucks doesn't mean that it's going to cost us as the tribe less to haul timber on our road.
Pine Top doesn't do any business except on the reservation, I'm told. I read in a brief.
That's true.
And so they sooner or later they're going to have to get their money back from somebody.
But the fact that they may amortize the price of the trucks out is an indirect cost, if at all. And the fact that they must pay a tax on the use of tribal roads is a direct cost to us.
And you make the same argument about repairs to the truck?
Yes, sir. I do.
Tune-ups at the garage?
Yes, sir. I do. The other thing that I think that the court is interested in, and I think that...
Is it correct to call it a tax on the use of the roads, or is it a tax on the gross receipts of their entire business?
It's a tax that's measured by use of our roads.
By miles traveled? Or?
Yes, sir, it is. And therefore, you have to have two things come together. You have to have the use of the roads, you have to have a vehicle, and the use of the roads. The roads are, you can't separate them from the tax. If you don't have the roads, they don't have a tax.
We're not talking about the motor fuel tax, we're talking about the other one now. And that is, that's how much, what is the tax? You know, I'm a little fuzzy.
It's 8 cents a gallon.
No, that's not the
that's
use
the diesel
of the roads.
Fuel.
That would be 8 cents a gallon wherever the gas was burned.
Right. Yes.
But now, what about the other tax?
It's 2.5% of the gross proceeds measured by
but
use of
the roads. But that's not per mile.
No.
It would depend on how much logs they carry and how much money they made and so forth.
Yes, it's 2.5.
So it's really not a tax on the use of the roads.
That's right. We have to give them 2.5 logs out of every 100 that we cut. That's what that tax is.
And that's no matter how far they have to haul the logs.
Yes.
So it's not really a tax on the use of the roads or a tax
on
distance.
If they don't haul the logs, they don't get the tax.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, but that's the same on buying the truck and all the other elements of doing business.
Yes. I understand. The other thing that I think that the court wants to look at is the potential for abuse of the tax. And because this tax and the transaction that you're dealing with is wholly on the reservation, that there is no potential for abuse. We're not dealing with Montana chain smokers or any of that sort of thing. This tax is wholly on the reservation. It's directly on a tribal enterprise. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, it is the position of the United States that the state of Arizona may not impose its motor carrier license tax or its use fuel tax on the logging and hauling activities of Petitioner Pine Top Logging Company on the reservation of the White Mountain Apache Tribe. That position rests, we believe, on a number of mutually reinforcing considerations, and it is no answer to our argument to examine any one in particular and to say that it is insufficient to validate the taxes. Before discussing those particular considerations in this case here, however, I would like to examine or identify the broader principles that underlie our analysis, hoping to show the Court that, in fact, it rests securely on principles that this Court has recognized in recent Indian tax decisions.
May I ask just one preliminary question, and then I won't interrupt anymore. Assume that the logging companies did half their business on the reservation. Would they be entitled to a 50% exemption from both taxes?
Yes. I assume that this is very much tied to the reservation locus, and I will explain
why. They would apportion on the basis of how much of their business.
Yes. Is. Yes. Mm-hmm. Before discussing those considerations here, however, I wish to identify these broader principles. These principles have been summarized in this Court's decisions in Warren Trading Post, in McClanahan, in Mescalero Apache Tribe, and in Moe against Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. First, as Moe and Mescalero make quite clear, federal instrumentality doctrine really no longer answers questions in this area, and we do not rely on federal instrumentality doctrine at all, which is to say we don't say simply because a burden falls on a tribe which has a connection to the federal government that alone invalidates the tax.
The same is true of commerce, I suppose.
Excuse me?
The same is true on the Indian commerce argument.
The Indian, I don't
I mean,
wish
just
to.
As such, unimplemented by any statutes.
No, I don't concede that, Your Honor.
Well, you go ahead then. I'll see.
I wish to adopt and rely on the remarks by Mr. Claiborne with respect to the Indian Commerce Clause. Our position does not rely on that doctrine. Second, although the concept of tribal sovereignty is still relevant, it is now defined to a large extent by treaties and by federal law. And as the Court noted in McClanahan, in the years since Worcester v. Georgia, notions of Indian sovereignty have been adjusted to take account of the state's legitimate interest in regulating the affairs of non-Indians. But to adjust something is not to eliminate it. And when you're talking about state regulation of affairs of non-Indians that take place upon a reservation, you simply cannot automatically assume that they have impunity to do what they wish to the non-Indians. The court considering whether a particular exercise of state power on a reservation must take account of the claims of tribal sovereignty as well as the customary powers of the state in dealing with its residents. Two tests for making this determination have been suggested by the court's decisions in Warren Trading Post and in Williams against Lee. The first test is, does the exercise of state power in some way preempted by a federal scheme? And the second test is, does it in some way infringe on tribal self-government? The two tests are independent, and the state's power may be defeated by either one. Nevertheless, the two are not necessarily unconnected, and we believe that, as in the circumstance of the present case, federal law may reflect a judgment of Congress concerning what conditions are essential to the continuing existence of tribal self-government.
Well, you know, you say they're independent.
They are independent, but they may, and sometimes...
That's clear enough, but you say they're interrelated. It seems to
sometimes.
Me they're rather inconsistent with each other.
No. No, I can understand that might be a superficial analysis that you can't
maybe
have.
Maybe that's very superficial, but superficially it sounds, they seem inconsistent.
If
we're talking about tribal independence, that means independence from anything and everything.
No.
Including federal control.
No, I believe this Court has always talked about a quasi-sovereignty, a dependent sovereignty.
Or quasi-independence.
Quasi-independence,
Independence
yes.
from state, but not from federal control.
That's correct, yes. Uh-huh. And when I talk about tribal self-government and tribal sovereignty, I am referring to that concept.
Right.
State actions likely to undermine the conditions which Congress in its scheme has defined as essential to preserving the tribal government of its own relation within its reservation would fail both tests. Of course, as the Court observed in Bryan v. Atascoca County, the government can also authorize the state to act in derogation of this sovereignty. And if it does, you might have a situation in which the state fails the infringement test and then is saved by some sort of congressional authorization. We believe that the taxes at issue in the present case fail both of the first two tests and are not saved by the third. First, as we have explained in our brief, a comprehensive network of laws and regulations governs the operation of tribal timber enterprises, which are conceived of as means of securing a secure economic base for the continued self-government of tribes having extensive timberlands on their reservations and for providing a source of employment for tribal members within their reservations. In other words, as we conceive the federal scheme here, it's not just a scheme for cutting down timber and supervising the roads. What is it? It's a scheme for making these tribal timber enterprises a basis for making the tribe self-sufficient within their reservation, allowing them to employ their members within their reservation and make it a going concern. Now, the Arizona taxes...
If they made the tribal scheme totally self-sufficient, so the tribes operated the logging enterprise themselves, then they would be tax exempt.
Yes, except that the tribe has found, and I believe this is in the record in one of the affidavits, that... it's not economical for them to try it. They did try it at one place on the reservation, Sebek, and found that it cost them more to do that.
If we sustain the state here, they'd have a competitive advantage in doing it themselves. It'd be an additional incentive, wouldn't it?
It's speculative. I'm not sure what the figures are.
To the extent that that's either a burden or a benefit.
Yes, right. I'm not sure to what extent that would be the case. The Arizona taxes at issue here would fall upon all of the logging contractors, not just Pine Top, and can reasonably be assumed as a practical matter to be passed on to the tribe. I don't think that's really contested. The state argues instead that legal incidence is what makes a difference. The record does not show what all of those taxes have amounted to in any given year, but the important point is this. The tax rate is determined by the state, quite independently of what the tribe's balance sheet might show in any given year. It's just an uncontrollable financial burden that is could be quite substantial and is inconsistent with what we think is the thrust of the federal scheme. Second, the taxes infringe on tribal sovereignty, and they do so in two ways. As we have argued, they interfere with the scheme that Congress has devised to foster and assure a viable tribal self-government. And they also represent an intrusion into the geographical territory of the tribe without the warrant of any strong state interest other than the desire to augment its general revenues. Now, the argument here is almost somewhat metaphysical. I think that's something of what makes Indian law a little difficult and complicated. It's a notion of what it means for a sovereign or a quasi-sovereign to have authority over its territory. And although the tribes clearly do not have absolute authority of their territory, cannot block the state at the boundaries of the reservation, nevertheless, it says something in derogation, in serious derogation of its powers over its territory, for the state to come onto the reservation and tax some activity with no interest, no legitimate interest, no regulatory interest, other than just the desire for more money. It's just a treatment of the boundaries as if they can be casually passed over without any serious reason to do so.
Is this argument wholly consistent with Moe?
Well, in Moe, yes, I think it is, because in Moe, what you had on the sale of the Indian trader to the non-Indians was a serious state interest in having marketing of taxes.
Here they come onto the reservation. They come onto the reservation, collect money, make the Indians collect it, and return it to the state.
Yes, but what was happening there, I believe the state's interest there, was losing revenue that it otherwise would have had. People would be moving, people would be coming onto the reservation to buy things that they otherwise would have bought the state.
The geographical matter is not a talismanic significance.
It's not talismanic, but I'm saying that the weight of the state's interest has some significance here.
Well, you haven't made a commerce argument yet. I guess you weren't.
Your Honor, we would rest upon. I would assume that the argument made in our brief in Central Arizona Machinery would apply here as well. We thought that in this case, the regulatory scheme decided required somewhat longer examination, and we didn't make that argument here. The taxes here, third, we do not think have been authorized by Congress either in the Buck Act or in the Hayden-Cartwright Act. For reasons that this Court found persuasive and convincing in the Warren Trading Post case, it found that the Buck Act does not apply to a tax on someone on an Indian reservation who's selling to Indians. And that's what the gross receipts tax, the motor carrier license tax here, it's absolutely, in many ways, identical to the tax here. I see my time is up.
Mr. McPherson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. At the outset, I think what I'd like to do is address a couple of questions that were raised by the Court during Mr. Wake's opening remarks, Mr. Brown's opening remarks, and the United States remarks. Specifically, it's my recollection that Justice Stevens was inquiring as to the question of whether or not we were talking about the same principles. Were we talking about a general gross receipts tax? What about Weyerhaeuser or some other company operating on the reservation? Would they be subject to a gross receipts tax if, in fact, we weren't talking about either the use fuel tax or the motor carrier tax? The answer to that question is yes. In footnote 13 of the petitioner's opening brief, we find a discussion of Arizona Revised Statutes Section 42.1309 and 13.12. Those were the statutes that were under consideration by this Court in Warren Trading Post. An examination of the Transaction Privilege Tax Code will reveal in ARS Section 42-1321 an exemption for the transportation of tangible personal property from point A to point B within the state of Arizona if the outfit, being purportedly otherwise subjected to the transaction privilege tax, pays a tax under 40-641. The point is, under 40-641, they are subjected to the motor carrier tax, which has a relationship to state roads, at a rate of 2.5%. Under Section 421310, which is under the Transaction Privilege Tax Code, they would otherwise be subject to the Transaction Privilege Tax with respect to hauling within the state of Arizona. They are exempted by virtue of state law under Section 42-1321. So the answer to Mr. Justice Stevens' question is, yes, a transaction privilege tax would apply to that transportation. Again, that's not the case that we have here this morning. But if that case were to come up, then the question becomes, would it be permissible as a matter of Indian law? Again, it would remain the state of Arizona's position that, yes, we are dealing with a non-Indian entity on an Indian reservation. Any economic burden of either the Arizona Transaction Privilege Tax, the motor carrier tax, or the use fuel tax, which may be visited upon the Indian entity on the reservation, arises solely by virtue of contractual negotiation. Nothing else. There is absolutely no requirement of state law under any of those three taxes that these costs be passed on or that the legal incidents be shifted over.
You would just draw the empirical line, I take it, that if between a tribal transportation operation and a non-tribal transportation operation. I suppose if you win this case, then the tribe liquidates Pine Top and operates itself, the transportation owns the trucks and operates, mm-hmm. You wouldn't tax them.
We would not tax them?
Mm-hmm.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Mr. Justice Marshall.
Take a big farm. Could you tax the transportation of the farm materials from one end of the farm to the other?
On the theory, does your hypo...
On any theory.
Does your hypothetical perceive those roads to be private roads?
Yes, sir.
No, sir, we would not.
Well, what's the difference?
Well, at this point, Your Honor, I think it would be appropriate, and I've discussed this with the court's leave, with Mr. Wake. By way of explanation as to the record in this case, there apparently was some misunderstanding with respect to exactly what issues were before the Arizona courts with respect to what roads and what taxes we were being taxing the use with respect thereto.
I'm fairly confused because he says that some state roads are used, some local roads are used, and I guess some are hybrid. I didn't get it from either one of the two. So why don't you tell me what roads are involved?
Very good, Your Honor. It is my understanding that the Pine Top operation occurs totally within the confines of the Fort Apache Indian Reservation. There are several types of roads on that reservation, including state highways. And this gets to the question that one of your other honors asked, what about this fact that they use state highways? With respect to the travel on those state highways, they have paid the taxes without protest. It's my recollection, Mr. Wake indicated that they choose not to challenge that. Certain other travel occurring on BIA-designated roads, tribal roads, and other types of roads on the reservation are the subject of the lawsuit here. With respect to travel on the BIA roads, it is the state of Arizona's position that the assessment in question relates to those, the use of those highways, and pursuant to federal law, even without regard to the Hayden-Cartwright Act, travel on those roads is specifically authorized by virtue of the Code of Federal Regulations.
Well, what's the difference between the BIA roads and Farmer Brown's roads in my hypothetical?
In your hypothetical, Your Honor, Farmer Brown's roads are private roads. By virtue of federal regulations, BIA roads are, quote, open to free public use, unquote, by mandate of the regulation. And that is the distinction.
Then if Farmer Brown said anybody wants to use those roads can use them, he'd be in trouble.
Mr. Justice Marshall, trouble, he would perhaps travel on those roads would be subjected to the tax. But so long as the road remains a private thoroughfare, they would not be subject. Travel and use fuel on those roads would not be subject to the state tax. With respect to the argument that this entire area has been preempted. It is the state of Arizona's position that quite the contrary. The federal regulatory scheme speaks in terms of sound silvicultural management of the forest resource. The federal objective is to protect the forest resource, to protect it from disease, fire, various other plagues and famines that might occur that would destroy or harm the forest resource. State of Arizona would respectfully submit that that preempts Area A, and we are talking about Area B. There is nothing in either the federal statutes or the Code of Federal Regulations upon which Pine Top and the tribe rely to indicate a congressional intent or indeed an intent on behalf of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to preempt costs. Indeed, the Code of Federal Regulations specifically provides with respect to the Bureau of Indian Affairs that administrative costs up to the extent of some 10% of the gross receipts of the tribal enterprise might be subjected to a charge to cover these administrative expenses. So the congressional objective, while it may be to protect the forest resource, there is nothing in the regulations, as was present in Warren Trading Post with respect to the prices that a trader could charge. There's nothing in these regulations to suggest that the costs that Pine Top incurs in pursuing its activities on the reservation are similarly preempted. We're talking about two different things. Mr. Brown mentioned that Public Law 280 was passed for purposes of permitting states to assume criminal jurisdiction and civil jurisdiction over civil causes of action. Well, in fact, this Court's decision in Bryan v. Itasca County establishes that that grant of authority by Congress does not extend to states if they desire to impose the direct legal obligation of state taxes upon reservation Indians. Quite the contrary. Public Law 280 was construed by this Court to extend to civil causes of action, tort cases, contract cases, access to the state courts. So if the suggestion be that had Arizona adopted Public Law 280, this would be a different case, Arizona would submit, it's just not so. This Court would have to ignore Bryan v. Itasca County.
I know maybe I'm not interrupting you. Good time. I'm not sure I understood everything, your entire response to Justice Marshall. I said there are different kinds of roads on the reservation. One was the state roads, and everybody agrees taxes are paid on the use of those. The other was the BIA roads. Are there also roads that are not public highways at all that are involved, such as roads going into the depth of the forest or anything like that?
Mr. Stevens, yes, there are.
And you're suing the right to tax on those, too.
Now, that puts the issue right before us. And this relates again to the discussions that Mr. Wake and I have had since arriving in Washington. The Arizona Court of Appeals opinion, which is before this Court, does not differentiate between BIA roads and tribal roads. The fact is, however, that the assessment that was made by the Arizona taxing authorities related only to the taxes attributable to Pine Top's operations on BIA roads. Use on tribal roads was extracted, that was not subjected to taxation. Now, it is true, and I must confess, that that position was not specifically or clearly advocated in the appellate briefs, nor does the Court of Appeals opinion make that distinction. However, the fact of the matter is that under current state law, under the legislative scheme that exists in Arizona right now, Arizona has no intention of going forward on some purported theory that because the Court of Appeals decision says we can, that we can go ahead and tax use on these tribal roads. I've been assured of that by my client by telephone last night. And other than that, we put that before the Court to apprise the Court of what the true facts are. The fact of the matter is, however, that that goes to the question of magnitude of what the burden is. By that I mean Mr. Wake's argument presumably will be, and I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but it's my understanding that if we were talking about use on tribal roads too, there would be a lot more...
Let me just interrupt again, if I may. The fight is over the use of tribal roads. That's where you're really in dispute. Is that right?
Well,
the BIA roads. I mean, BIA roads. I'm sorry.
That's correct, Your Honor. BIA roads.
Which you say are public roads, but under the Arizona Supreme Court's opinion, it's broad enough to cover those roads even if they weren't public roads.
Right? Mr. Justice,
and
no.
You don't, pardon me?
No, if I may correct.
I know you don't defend that position, but I thought, reading the opinion, I thought it would apply to that.
Well, the Court of Appeals opinion states that with respect to all of the roads, tribal roads, BIA roads, all of the roads, go ahead and impose these taxes.
And you don't defend that position?
I don't defend that position. I defend it to the extent that the term tribal roads includes BIA roads,
right,
because there was no differentiation.
What I meant to say is that your real fight is over the right to tax on BIA roads.
That
does
is
the record tell us much about those roads? For example, does it tell us whether the state police are on those roads or whether they have speed limits or things like that?
Your Honor, the record does not specifically go into that much detail.
So the
However,
record presents us with a hypothetical case quite different from the one you ask us to decide.
Well, Mr. Justice Stevens, the case was brought here by the petitioners, but yes, we felt it necessary as an ethical consideration to apprise the court of what the actual situation is. But having said that, the legal issue, if it please the court, may still be decided with respect to the BIA road use. The fact of the matter is that BIA roads, pursuant to the Code of Federal Regulations, are required to be open to free public use as a matter of federal law.
Yes, but does that tell us whether the state spends any money in their maintenance and protection and policing and so forth, which would make it, you know, the case would be different depending on what the facts are?
The record does not specifically present us with those facts. However, there are facts in the record to indicate that the posting of speed limits, for example, are done by other than at least with respect to the tribal roads, are done by jurisdictions other than the state of Arizona.
What about the BIA roads?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that we do not take the position that we may establish speed limits on BIA roads. Perhaps Mr. Wake can fill me in on that. The only roads that we exercise jurisdiction over, and again, only with respect to non-Indians, the law in Arizona is that even if we have a state highway through a reservation, we cannot assert direct jurisdiction over Indians on those roads.
Yeah, but these people are not Indians.
That's quite correct.
Well, I don't know what we're supposed to decide here, Frank.
Well, if it pleases the court, Arizona's position is this. The legal question as to whether or not these state taxes may be applied under notions of this exists in an area other than a preempted area, or under notions of the application of the Hayden-Cartwright Act, can be decided on the BIA road issue alone. The fact of the matter is that if we talk about the tribal roads, and as I was attempting to explain, Mr. Wake's argument probably will be, and again, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but if we're talking about the authority of the state to impose these taxes on tribal roads as well, then the amount, the economic burden of these taxes is going to be much greater. And therefore, Mr. McPherson's argument that the magnitude of these taxes is of some relevance goes out the window, because the footnote that we have in our brief, based upon the record, attempts to establish a percentage of what the true economic burden is with respect to a particular time period. That percentage would change by going up if the state were taxing the tribal roads as well. But that's a consideration apart from the question of BIA road use and whether or not the Hayden-Cartwright Act applies.
Mr. McPherson, quite apart from the question in this case, which involves Indians and Indian tribes, what about a private owner of land who buys, whether it's a Weyerhaeuser company or a rancher who owns many square miles of ranch land? Does Arizona impose a tax upon his fuel if the vehicle that he owns is used exclusively on his own private property 365 days a year, or this year 366, and never on the public roads of Arizona?
It does not, Your Honor.
It does not.
That's correct.
Could it?
Could it? Presumably it could, but it has not. And that is the basis upon which the tribal roads were taken out of the exemption. They were not, or excuse me, taken out of the assessment. They were not taken out by virtue of the fact that they were Indian roads. They were taken out by virtue of the fact that they were private roads.
Yeah.
And that is the current state of the law.
Does Arizona also allow a taxpayer to allocate on the basis of mileage driven in, say, New Mexico, and subtract that in some way from the amount of the tax due to Arizona?
Your Honor, yes, it does.
Is the same privilege accorded to a taxpayer with respect to mileage driven on Indian reservation roads?
Your Honor, it is not, and that is the question that we have here. At least the argument that is being advanced, my understanding of the argument being advanced by Pinetop, is that that is the vice in the Arizona statute. It does not allocate between use on state roads within the reservation and roads other than state roads on the reservation.
Well, I had not understood Pinetop's argument to be a question of discrimination. I had understood it to be an argument of preemption and it seems to me that perhaps a narrower ground might exist here where the Arizona tax is faulty, in that if it allows such a deduction for travel in New Mexico, but not on the White River reservation roads, is it entitled to make that sort of discrimination under the Constitution?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I would submit that it is not, for this reason. In the first instance, the travel outside the state of Arizona occurs in a jurisdiction beyond the jurisdictional reach of Arizona. Now, having said that, the question becomes, is the Fort Apache Indian Reservation beyond the jurisdiction, the tax reach, if you will, of Arizona? Arizona would submit that no, it is not. Number one, this is based on this Court's decision in Surplus Trading v. Cook. It also would presuppose the existence of a state within a state or a nation within a state.
My question was phrased, I believe, is Arizona allowed to make this distinction? You answered it is not. The follow-up indicates to me that you meant it is allowed to make that distinction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, it is allowed to make that distinction. It has not made that distinction. That would present a different case, and I'm sure that, you know, there would be, well, I'm not sure, but there would likely be litigation over that point as well.
Did I understand you to say that Arizona has no responsibility for maintaining the BIA roads?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And did it contribute to the construction of those roads?
So far as the record shows, it did not, Your Honor.
And no police responsibility either?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, we haven't really discussed this Court's decision in Oliphant. With respect to jurisdiction over non-Indians, for example, if a non-Indian robs a bank, a bad example, that's federal, robs a convenience market in White River and goes running off to a tribal road, question, can state DPS officers chase him? That's a separate question, but
it'll be settled if ever it happens. It'll be settled.
What about the tribal roads? Did you respond as to that? Maintenance of tribal roads?
The state does not contribute to the maintenance of the tribal roads. However, if it pleases the Court, we have attempted in footnote 35 of our brief to explain that is a state law question that has been specifically decided against the position advanced by Pinetop Logging. Fact of the matter is that under this Court's decisions in Thomas v. Gay and Kelly v. Pittsburgh, which is cited in Thomas v. Gay, there's no ironclad requirement of benefits burdens for purposes of determining whether the tax is applicable or not. Surely it's one of the considerations, and it's one of the considerations that Pinetop is making, they're basing their argument upon. But the fact of the matter is, as a matter of state law, it is Arizona's position that that question has been resolved against them. The thrust of their position is based upon notions of preemption and Indian sovereignty. And with respect to the discussion of both, or all three, of the council, this question of self-government, which continues to be discussed, Arizona would submit, should not be considered in a vacuum. The fact of the matter is that an attribute of sovereignty is the negotiation of contracts. There is no requirement of state law that these taxes be borne by them. If they want to contract them away, that's fine. With respect to a final question asked by Justice Stevens in the opening remarks, the competitive advantage of the tribe that would be enjoyed if the decision of the Court of Appeals were reversed merits a little closer examination. Fact of the matter is that there is nothing in the statutes or the Code of Federal Regulations, that Arizona can see at least, that suggests that as a matter of economic principle and in connection with the federal objective of providing or permitting the generation by the forest resource of the whatever profit.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, Council.
Thank you.